evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, your designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. Hope you're enjoying a wonderful Memorial Day weekend with your family. You don't have to work tomorrow, folks, so you can stay up late with us. And I think the program we have for you tonight will be worth your time. Special thank you tonight to the families of all those who made the ultimate sacrifice for our country. You know, I've said it before, I think Memorial Day is perhaps our most thoughtful holiday of all, but we sometimes forget it's not just about barbecues and a day away from the office. Appropriately tonight, our focus is on American warriors, Cold War warriors, those who toiled in obscurity to protect our freedoms, who put it all on the line and made great personal sacrifices to keep all of us safe during some of the darkest times in our nation's history. And they did so without anyone knowing about what they were doing. I'm talking about the men and women of Groom Lake, better known as Area 51. As many of you know, I've been following the story of America's most legendary secret base for more than 20 years. The news stories that we broke here in Las Vegas back in the late 80s put that base on the map, launched the legend, so to speak. And now the facility out there in the Nevada desert is the best-known secret base, and I'm using secret in quotation marks, in the world. It's also the hottest topic in the country right now, because of a controversial new book that takes the lid off of Area 51 in greater detail than ever before, and which takes specific aim at some of the best-known legends and lore, and specifically I mean the allegation that alien technology has been stored and tested out there. This new book by Annie Jacobson has generated huge interest and huge controversy among pro and anti-UFO forces, even among the Groom Lake workers who were interviewed for the book. People have a lot of questions about the wild scenario described at the end of this book, based largely on testimony from a highly placed but anonymous source from Area 51. Author Annie Jacobson is here with us for 2 hours tonight, and I think this is going to be one heck of a conversation coming up in just a couple of minutes. Then in hours 3 and 4, a warrior of another sort, Richard Lang, is out there on the front lines of the UFO controversy. He's a boots-on-the-ground kind of UFO investigator who's worked on some of the most important cases in modern history, and he's now launching a new investigative unit of the highest professional standards. We'll hear about his new organization and some mind-numbing cases in the second half of tonight's program. As always, webmaster Lex and I put together a little pile of excerpts and oddities, items that caught our attention from the news during the last week. Check them out when you get a moment on Coast to Coast's website. Let's take our break and come right back with author Annie Jacobson and her sensational story about Area 51. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Annie Jacobson is a contributing editor at the LA Times Magazine and an investigative reporter whose work has also appeared in the National Review and Dallas Morning News. She's a graduate of Princeton University. Her new book, Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base, is an important book in my view. It's been getting attention all over the country, including some folks taking some pretty hard shots at the author. Annie, I really appreciate you coming on to talk to us.
George, it is a pleasure to be here, especially as you are in my book.
I am. We'll talk about some of that. I wanted you to start with, perhaps you can describe how you got hooked. This happened at a dinner, right? How you got hooked on the subject?
It was 2007. I was at a Christmas Eve dinner, and an then 88-year-old scientist leaned over to me and said, "Boy, have I got a story for you." Now, I hear that a lot. I'm a national security reporter for the Los Angeles Times Magazine. But what Ed Lovick, that's the name of the scientist, told me was really incredible. He was the lead physicist on the team that invented stealth technology for the CIA. And then when I found out that the test flight work took place at Area 51, I was really intrigued and I wanted to know more.
Had you heard the stories? Were you up on the lore of Area 51 prior to that conversation?
Well, I think it's impossible to be an American citizen over the age of 10 and not have heard of Area 51. And I certainly had heard of Area 51, but it wasn't, you know, it was not in my area of expertise, or it wasn't really in my area of interest, actually, until suddenly when Lovick told me that, and he explained to me that the reason he could tell me that at that dinner at age 88 was because the CIA had just declassified his work that took place there, beginning back when Eisenhower was president in 1957. And so I kind of smiled and thought to myself, how interesting, this place is really rooted in national security. And then, of course, investigating it, I found so many more facets of Area 51 that are rooted in so many other interesting things.
Had you ever, as a national security reporter, had you ever crossed paths with just UFO subjects in general?
Yes and no. I mean, one is interested in them, certainly. I love curious people. I myself am very curious, and I find that desire for knowledge to be enticing and invigorating. So absolutely, I have, you know, I listen to George's show on Coast to Coast whenever I'm up that late.
You know, one of the things that comes across, it's not spelled out in so many words, at least not that I saw, but one of the things that comes across, and you make the point early in the book, is that secrets can be kept, even big secrets known by a lot of people, and Area 51 is a perfect example of that.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the first things I did, or not one of the first things, but one of the earlier things I did with Lovick was go to the banquet at Lockheed up in Palmdale when the F-117 fighter bomber was retired. And it was fascinating to me that in the opening speech, the sort of person in charge of Lockheed Skunk Works at the time gave some astounding number of the people that were able to keep the F-117 bomber secret. It was 10,000 people. That's a guesstimate, but it was definitely up in the five figures.
So describe for me the process then, how you sort of start peeling the onion and get some of these Cold War veterans to trust you enough to open up.
Well, in speaking to Lovick, I wanted to learn more, and I was learning about the U-2 at that time. I was fascinated that that famous spy plane that became public when Gary Powers was shot down over the Soviet Union in 1960 was the CIA's first espionage platform out there at Area 51, also called Groom Lake. And so I said to Lovick, okay, well, who else can I talk to? And he referred me to the original mechanic on the U-2 named Bob Murphy, Lockheed Skunk Works worker who eventually became director of operations all the way through the F-117. And, you know, one by one, I talked to Bob Murphy, and then it was like, oh, you need to talk to T.D. Barnes. And then, oh, you must talk to Ken Collins, the CIA spy pilot who flew the Oxcart. And, you know, now you must talk to Commander Slater. And so it went. One by one, I was introduced to this amazing group of Cold Warriors who were almost completely secret to the outside world, certainly as a group, but were known among themselves as this group of heroes.
You know, some of the most interesting things that I have learned from those guys, the Roadrunners and other people from out at Groom Lake, are the sacrifices, the personal sacrifices that they've made. In addition, specifically, the kinds of cover stories they had to tell to their own families.
Absolutely. I mean, Jim Friedman, who was an early employee at EG&G, he photographed nuclear bombs, he wired nuclear bombs. Then he went over and worked at Area 51 for 14 years, longer than most people actually end up being there. He told me and described in length the cover story that he used with his family, and that was that he fixed TVs. So he would come home from a day blowing up nuclear weapons, and they would say, his wife would say, how was your day, honey? And he would say, it was fabulous. I fixed 12 TVs.
Describe for me the quality of the people you met out there. I know I know how I would answer that question, but I wanted you to explain it for our audience.
Well, the amazing thing is that these are men who are up there in age, in the third act of their lives, so to speak. Some very old. Ray Gowdy, test pilot for Lockheed, now 92. Ed Lovick, the physicist I told you that helped me to even begin this investigative journey, now 92, both sharp as tacks. But these are people who have such great character and courage and spent their lives working on these amazing projects and programs that they did assuming that they would never get any credit for anything that they did, that it would be secret, that it would go with them to the grave. And so I had a really remarkable time interviewing. Most of the men that I interviewed across a period of 2 years. So some I did just interview twice, let's say, but many of them, they were these long, drawn-out interviews because everything that they said was so interesting. Keep in mind, George, and you know this because you know a lot of the roadrunners, they, to wind up at Area 51 as, let's say, a radar expert or a expert mechanic in a Mach 3 engine, you have to be at the absolute top of your game, and you have to have a background that is astonishing in its own right. And so in talking to a lot of these cold warriors, I would find out about, let's just say, the Battle of Okinawa, what that was like, or the Battle of Bastogne. I mean, talking about going back to World War II when some of these men were young men that left college to go fight against the Nazis or fight against the Japanese, and that's where their career launched from.
I'm always amazed to hear the stories of what life was like for them out in the desert once they were all assembled out there. I mean, it was a world unto itself.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, all the little details, too, of, like, you know, the different agents, the different groups they worked for, whether it was EG&G or Lockheed or Hughes or General Atomics, they would issue them things like rattlesnake-proof boots or flashlights that they could wear on their head. You know, one of the scientists told me an amazing detail when he said that they took a moment out in the desert to kind of take a break when this was in the late 50s, when the Soviet satellites were known to be going overhead spying on Area 51, and they would have to put all the equipment away in the hangars and kind of wait. And one day they went out walking into the desert there, and Lovick said to me, "I saw a coyote chasing a rabbit, and they were both walking."
Describe for me, sort of take a couple of minutes and go through a laundry list of the programs that were out there, and describe for me how tough it was to get information, documents, things of that sort about each of them, even after CIA said in 2007 that they could start talking about some of it.
Well, chronologically wise, what I found fascinating and what at first really piqued my interest was the fact that Area 51's nearest neighbor was the Nevada test site. And I know I've been criticized widely for not knowing how to pronounce Nevada. I know it's Nevada, but I'm from Connecticut, and it's like I can't say Nevada. So just, listener, forgive me. But the Nevada test site, the neighbor, where we're blowing up these nuclear bombs. And from someone like myself, who was born in 1967, I'm about half the age of most of the guys in my book, and the idea that we were, I mean, I knew we blew up bombs out in the Marshall Islands, testing nuclear weapons during the Cold War arms race, but I had no idea, truly, that we had exploded over 100 bombs in Las Vegas, outside of Las Vegas, 75 miles north. And so this idea that Area 51's nearest neighbor was an atomic bombing range was stunning to me, and that was a really interesting area of investigation that I wanted to pursue, because if you are dealing with nuclear secrets, you are dealing with secrecy. As I write right in the beginning of the book, there is this astonishingly separate system of secret keeping that the Atomic Energy Commission, now called the Department of Energy, enjoys, which allowed it to keep secrets separate from the presidential system of national security keeping. And so all these nuclear workers had what are called Q clearances to work on nuclear secrets, as well as top secret clearances. So the movement back and forth between Area 51 and the Nevada test site was very fluid. When Richard Bissell, the first CIA program director out there at Area 51 on the U-2 spy plane, wanted people to work on the Groom Lake project, the U-2, he would employ people from the Nevada test site because all their clearances were in place. And so you saw a kind of swinging open door between these two areas, and yet what was very stunning, mysterious, and evocative to me was that, wait a minute, how interesting, Area 51 is not inside the Nevada test site, it's right outside the Nevada test site. What does that suggest? It suggests it's not really part of it, it's outside of it. And I found that that, as I began to study the chronology of all these different espionage programs that took place out there, later weapons programs, later bomber programs, it made perfect sense to me how you could keep secrets in that kind of environment.
Okay, U2 was the first program.
Okay, yes. So you asked the chronology. You got the at Area 51 proper, Groom Lake, and also remember, and you know, I don't have to tell you this, George, because you are an expert on Area 51. It's a big land parcel. It's got craggy mountain ranges and areas, sub areas where you have other things going on, like Area 13, just north of Area 51, but still inside that restricted airspace known as the box. That's where one of the earlier tests, right around the same time that the U-2 was being test flown, there was a fascinating project that took place by the Atomic Energy Commission, and that was called Project 57, and that was the idea of exploding setting off a dirty bomb to see what would happen if a airplane carrying a nuclear weapon were to crash on American soil. And that project indeed contaminated 895 acres of land out there with plutonium, which we know has a half-life of 24,000 years. So you've got U2 going on, and then just 5 or 6 miles north, you have this plutonium project. I tell that story in my book through the eyes of Richard Mingus, who is a security guard at the time, both at Area 51 and then kind of moonlighting up there at Area 13 on the dirty bomb project. The base closed down for a little while after that, having to do with fallout from some of the nuclear tests. This is what I learned from the archives, my archive research. All the U-2s were moved out of the area, and there was a couple years where very little is known, at least to me, about what happened at Groom Lake from kind of late 1957 till 1959 when the next CIA project came in, and that was the A-12 Oxcart, this Mach 3 spy plane that is known to many locals and so many of the roadrunners worked on.
And then a whole other series in later years, the SR-71.
Yes, next, and then also sort of in the, as a, you know, it's interesting, and I take the reader through this whole kind of Cold War chronology through the different men who worked on these projects, but there was this incredible, you know, fight in the Cold War against the Soviet Union, and these espionage platforms were being developed by the CIA to spy on Russia because we had such limited capabilities to put spies on the ground because of the nature of how difficult it was to for the CIA to function inside Russia. And so these spy spy planes were meant to peer down over the Iron Curtain, take photographs, provide intelligence for the CIA to make informed decisions for the president. And then along came Vietnam, and there was a pull away from the Cold War proper to this idea of the Vietnam War, this imbroglio, this mess that we were involved in. But one of the great, amazing programs that I learned that came out of that was in the late 60s, the MiG reverse engineering of a Soviet MiG out there at Groom Lake, and that's because the CIA made a deal with the Mossad to get the MiG after the Mossad captured it from an Iraqi Air Force colonel named Munir Redfa. And we brought the MiG to Groom Lake, according to some of the men that I worked with on this part of the story, and reverse engineered that MiG. And then that was called the technical phase of the program. And then the tactical phase of that program was putting the MiG back together, flying it in mock air battles in the skies over Groom Lake, and learning why it was that this MiG, Soviet MiG fighter jet, which the North Vietnamese were flying, was able to shoot down so many American pilots. And we discovered in those mock air battles how to beat the MiG, and that became the Top Gun fighter school. So again, you have this other program that has, you know, the backstory behind the backstory leading you back to Area 51.
Well, I think that it is no exaggeration to say, and I've said it before, that the Cold War was won at Area 51, but those guys out there played a direct role in that victory.
They did, and then they just kept on going. I mean, the next thing, you know, after the Vietnam War ended, there was a movement toward taking stealth to a totally different degree as computers appeared on the scene. So the early stealth was developed with a slide, you know, slide rules and kind of, you know, Ed Lovick describing to me what it was like, these guys kind of stomping, literally, you know, pouring chemicals into buckets and stomping yes. around in it with their feet.
Andy Jacobson is my guest. She's the author of the new book, Area 51, An Uncensored History. When we come back, we'll look at some of the criticisms that have been raised about this book. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Andy Jacobson about Area 51, the world's best-known secret base. Is that a contradiction in terms of best-known secret? Can you still have a secret if everybody on the planet knows that you're out there and knows sort of what you're up to? When we come back, we'll jump into what is going on at Groom Lake these days, what role it plays in the battle against terrorism, and then into some more controversial stuff, specifically the ending of the Annie Jacobson's new book, which is far wilder than any of the stories about aliens out at Area 51. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp. My guest tonight is Annie Jacobson, author of this massive and important new book, Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base. Annie, you know, every once in a while, these reports will surface or rumors online that Area 51 is shut down, that it's moved to Utah. It's not there anymore, which is, of course, preposterous. There are those who would have expected, though, after the Cold War is done, maybe it would shut down because its primary mission was over. But it's got a lot of new things to do, right?
Absolutely, and you don't have to look further than Google Images to see that. What's interesting is that the base got smaller, from what I understand and from what I researched and learned about, after the Berlin Wall came down. But as soon as the War on Terror was initiated, the base built back up at a remarkable pace. It's where a lot of those drones were test flown, and now it appears to be bigger than ever and only getting bigger.
And what role does it play in the war against terrorism? What kind of things are going on out there?
Well, you know, my book, I do not write a lot about what's going on there in the exact present tense, because all of that would be speculation. The guys that I work with that are now in their 80s, who are, let's say, radar experts out there, and were working immediately after Sputnik, you know, back in the 58, let's say, they believe that, based on looking at the radar that's out there now, is that we're probably doing a lot of work with developing a stealth satellite, because so much of the world works on, you know, most of the foreign powers move their equipment. If it's out in the open, they move it underground or they move it into a hangar when a satellite is known to pass overhead. And obviously, if you had a stealth satellite, that would change the game. There's another interesting story that I tell in the book about some sources who told me about a mock buildup that we did of Bin Laden's compound. This is back before 9/11, when he lived and operated out of Karnak Farms in Afghanistan, and he was a wanted man by the FBI, and the Air Force and the CIA teamed up for the first time to decide to try and equip the Predator drone with missiles. Of course, now this is commonplace, but back in the late 90s, this was a new idea, and there was the sense that there would be collateral damage if this compound were attacked by these missiles off of a Predator drone, and Bin Laden was known to often entertain members of Middle Eastern royal families. So the two agencies got together, the agency and the Air Force, to see what that would be like out there, and apparently things went well and it was quite accurate, but then there were some complications between the State Department and different CIA deciding whether or not it was a good idea to take out Bin Laden with these drone missiles. And they, in the end, they decided not to.
You know, we touched on this briefly about the secrecy out there. You mentioned that the guys that you interviewed would just be guessing about what goes on out there today. They didn't always know what was going on out there when they worked, though. I remember T.D. Barnes telling us a story. He used this line: you could be in the chow line with the same guy for 5 years and not ever know what the guy was working on.
Absolutely, and I write about the need to know as a central theme throughout my book. I consulted with the lead historian for the National Reconnaissance Office to learn about what need to know really means. And this is how it was summed up for me. Basically, you can't really know because the protocols about need to know are themselves classified. So I really have to chuckle when anybody, a roadrunner or anyone for that matter, says, well, that couldn't have happened out of Area 51, but this did, because everyone that ever worked out there knows that they only had a need to know about what they worked on. And anyone you interview who is out at Area 51 will tell you, by the way, I'm just telling you what I can tell you because much of my work is still classified. So it's a little ironic that anyone would think that they would really know, including myself, the be-all and the end-all of what goes on at Area 51, because you don't have a need to know. It's kind of like, remember when Donald Rumsfeld was quoted during the Iraq War saying, you know, well, you never know what you don't know? And right. People really kind of made fun of him. But it's actually very true. You don't know what you don't know. And there is no better you don't know than Area 51.
And that question is particularly relevant concerning your book and the end of the book, the last seven mm-hmm. pages that has generated so much controversy. A lot of the roadrunners and people who worked out there are a little upset with you because you included that. And this chapter is stuff that they clearly knew nothing about. Go ahead and tell the story. How you contacted this source and what tale he told you.
Well, you know, all of the men in my book know one another. And they are all known to one another, but none of them know what the others know. And this is what it's almost like a perfect enigma in and of itself about Area 51. It's like the riddle inside the puzzle inside the riddle, like Winston Churchill once said of the Soviet Union. But in my book, I report, you know, my book is 400 pages, George, and then over 100 pages of notes. And for 367 pages, I give you straight form journalism, like this happened, and here you can look in the notes, and you can see that I fact-checked against this and that and this document, and Joe corroborated it, and Larry said this, you know, so on and so forth, made up names. Real names in the book, but I'm very clear about how I fact-checked the information. And then at the very end of the book, seven pages left, I say to you, all these great things happened out at Area 51. You know, we were kept safe because of this and the U-2 spy plane and the ox cart and bravo. But, however, dear reader, that's not why Area 51 is still classified. Because remember, the base itself is classified. The word Area 51 is redacted out of all documents except for two which I found looking through the archives, and most likely those are mistakes. And so I lean into the dear reader and I say, here's why it's still classified according to one of my sources, the only source of the 74 who needs to remain anonymous. And here is what he told me. And I tell you, and I'm very clear about saying, here's what he told me. And I'm very clear about saying, there is nothing to check this against because it's still classified. Or the way that I say it is, it's not declassified. And what the source told me was that he worked on the equipment that came from Wright-Patterson, that originally came from Roswell, and that equipment was a flying circular-shaped disc which had been sent not by Martians, but by Joseph Stalin. And I explained to you that this is a single-source story, and I explained to you that the source, his information, his credibility has been fact-checked by me, the author, to the degree that I feel comfortable reporting it to you this way. And I stand by that, George, with all of my gusto, because I believe that what the source told me is true.
You are reporting it as he told it to you. Do you believe that it actually happened this way?
I report it exactly as he told me. I have no reason not to believe him. In the notes, I make a note that it is possible that what the source told me was in part information that had been given to him. In other words, there's clearly what the source knows. What the source did. I absolutely believe the source when he said to me, "I received the equipment." I absolutely believe when the source says to me, I received the equipment, and then the really jaw-dropping part that so many people have problems with is the source also told me this round-shaped disc that was sent by Stalin had inside of it child-size aviators. And those child-size aviators had been deformed in some manner, genetic birth defects, possibly genetically somehow manipulated, surgically manipulated. He does not know, does not claim to know, but they were deformed in a manner that made them appear to be otherworldly, and that is where the iconic images of the aliens sprung forth from. And he explained to me that he saw them and dealt with them, meaning, you know, handled them in as much as they were in the hangar with the equipment on life support. And all of that, I absolutely do not doubt the veracity of him when he says to me, this is what I did, and this is what happened. When he explains to me, this is what I was told, this is what I was told where it came from, this is what I was told who was involved in it, that is clearly secondhand information that came to him. And I differentiate between that. And I also do this in 7 pages. And, you know, this is not what my 500-page book is about, but it is, I believe, a very important part of the puzzle and the riddle and the enigma that is Area 51, and that is why I chose to include it in the book. And I wouldn't do it any differently.
Tell me a bit about the source, his background, why you find him credible, and also tell me who told him this stuff, this account.
Well, I have an agreement with the source to keep him anonymous, so what I say is limited, but I'll tell you, George, exactly what I told Terry Gross on NPR and others, in that I examined the sources. The source worked for and with the Atomic Energy Commission across 3 decades. He was given many awards and certificates, all of which I examined. I examined his war records. I examined his military records. I examined his medical records. I interviewed many of his friends and colleagues. I interviewed his family members. I interviewed everything that I, any information that he ever told me, and we interviewed for well over 100 hours across what has now been 2 years. All of the information that he gave me checked out as truthful and fact-based. And so to sort of postulate that he would make up a story, as some have said, is just, that is not, first of all, it's not my instinct and my experience as a reporter with someone who tells the truth in a 100% of other cases. And it's just not plausible for me. People are welcome to their opinions, but to me, that is what they seem to be.
Describe for me then his team and what they were doing, with the craft, what they were doing with these beings.
Yes, and also, George, remember, as I've discussed with you, the information that he was willing to share with me was very limited, and I make that extraordinarily clear in my book, because we would discuss other aspects of his career with the Atomic Energy Commission, which obviously involved nuclear weapons, since that's what the Atomic Energy Commission is in the business of doing, and certainly was in the 50s and 60s. We would discuss that for hours, and then I would say, may I ask you 1 or 2 questions about the subject that is so difficult. And what you asked me, the question of where he got his information, and that had a lot to do with my understanding of the veracity of his, where I believed what he was telling me was important in terms of American history. Because according to the source, the man in charge of the program was Vannevar Bush, who was the head of the Manhattan Project. So there I had been researching and learning all about the Manhattan Project, which was the bid to build the atomic bomb. And, you know, a common preconception is that General Leslie Groves was the head of the Manhattan Project with Oppenheimer as the lead scientist. But you don't have to dig too deep to figure out that actually Vannevar Bush was in charge of both of them. He was the president's science advisor. He was in charge of the nuclear bomb. And so he was the head of the mother of all black operations. And when I learned from my source that it was Vannevar Bush who was in charge of this program and the follow-on program that's so controversial, according to my source, that involved the equipment and the child-sized aviators from the Roswell crash. The idea that Vannevar Bush was in charge of this project made perfect, sort of terrifying sense to me.
What was the work that the team was doing? What did he describe day-to-day they were doing with the equipment
well,
and the bodies?
Well, my source worked on the project for 2 weeks. So the equipment, when it arrived at a hangar, and I describe in the book exactly where it was, sort of northwest of Groom Lake, the source was on a team of 5 engineers that were tasked with taking apart this round-shaped flying craft, allegedly sent by Stalin, taking it apart down to its rivets and nuts and bolts and components, and seeing what made it fly, getting a sense of how the power plant worked. Now, as far as understanding the technology that made it fly, the source has never purported to have been involved with that. That's other people's interpretations. According to him, it went on to another team at EG&G who was in charge of reverse engineering this hover and fly technology, and according to the source, they were able to figure that out. But he did not have anything to do with that. His work was simply taking it apart and putting it back together.
And the beings?
The beings, very, very uncomfortable discussions about that. You know, I write in the book that what I could get out of him was the description of them, the fact that they were comatose. There were 2 of them, according to him, that came with the equipment. They were comatose but alive. They were hooked up to some kind of life support system. I know that very rudimentary in 1951, and that one of them died shortly after arriving at this hangar to the northwest of Area 51. But that they had very large heads, very big eyes, almost no nose, and that they were, you know, small. And that's why they're called child-sized aviators.
Well, they sure sound like aliens, the classic alien, as you mentioned. And how was it that these beings were created? That's also an interesting part of the story.
Yes. Well, remember that what I write in the book, I asked the source at length, what was the point of this? And his answer was that Stalin was aware of the War of the Worlds and its impact and effect on America. We know Hitler was. He referenced it in the speech. But Stalin was most interested in it, in this idea of black propaganda, and that the reason that he sent this flying craft and these grotesquely deformed humans who had been the result of some kind of a horrific human experimentation project, according to the source, who I believe, that this unit and these child-sized aviators had been sent here a la a kind of War of the World hoax, and that it was sent over New Mexico. New Mexico was home to Los Alamos, the nuclear facility, home to Sandia, where we made our weapons, home to the Roswell base, where the 509th Bomb Group, the only bombers that could handle nuclear weapons at the time in 1947 were based, and the idea was to kind of scare the heck out of Americans and at the same time make it very clear to Truman that this was kind of a warning shot over America's bow, over Truman's bow, that we may have had the nuclear bomb in 1947 and the Soviets did not yet, but Stalin had the ability to manipulate people through black operations and black propaganda.
Yeah, that's a really interesting tale that I find, as you and I discussed the other day, I just find has a heck of a lot of holes in it. And I would wonder, and I guess you admit in the book in your notes that your source was told this information, that it might have been a cover story by his boss, that it wasn't a literal story, it was just and if you look in the Roswell archives, the lore about Roswell, there were many witnesses who say that they were told this stuff came from Russia. Philip Corso writes that was one of the stories that he handed out when he was supposedly distributing Roswell wreckage to national labs. So I'm just wondering how seriously you consider the possibility that your source was given this as a cover story, even though he was working on the inside.
Yes, and that's a very legitimate question, George. And again, I'm neither for nor against, you know, anything in this regard other than standing by the veracity of what I was told. It's not a false memory. It's not a fantasy. Right. It's the information that I believe to be legitimate from someone who is there. Now, one of the questions I asked the source.
I'll tell you what, Annie, I shouldn't have asked you that question right as we're coming up to the break, so I'm going to ask you to hold on, and audience, stay with us. We've had some information today that somebody claims that Annie's source has been identified. We'll get into that as well when we come back here on Coast to Coast AM.